Good morning, I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. My guest on the show today is Bob Barr, running for president this year as a Libertarian Party candidate. He's on the ballot in most states, and in places where there are close races between the two mainstream party candidates, he could play a deciding role. Bob Barr represented Georgia's 7th Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives from 1995 to 2003. He was a Republican at the time. He became a Libertarian a few years ago and is a champion of smaller government. He joins us this morning on Radio Times to talk about his policies and ideas. Bob Barr, welcome to Radio Times. Good morning.
Marty, good morning. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, I do want to open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY to book questions to our guest, Bob Barr. Bob Barr, tell us about your conversion from Republican to Libertarian.
The Republican Party of this early 21st century bears virtually no real relationship to the Republican Party that I grew up with and that I was very active in, including much of the time I was in the Congress. The modern Republican Party of George W. Bush and the majority in the Congress up until a couple of years ago is a party that believes very much in big government, centralized government power, pretty much absolute power in the hands of the executive, and that means complete undermining of individual liberty. So, the party of 2008 or 2006, when I formally joined the Libertarian Party, was not the Republican Party of years past. The Libertarian Party, on the other hand, which actually had worked against me in my electoral loss in 2002, is a party, the only political party in America that is firmly committed to a mainstream philosophy of dramatically shrinking the size, the scope, the cost, and the power of the federal government and dramatically increasing individual liberty.
And I do want to get to all of that, but do you then regret your vote for the Patriot Act, for the Iraq War Resolution, your authorship of the Defense of Marriage Act, your support for the war on drugs? Are those all votes that you regret now as a Libertarian?
Well, I mean, it isn't, so much that I go around regretting things. The fact of the matter is that the vote for the Iraq War was based on a very faulty set of information that was presented to me and other members of Congress. The resolution that was presented to us was accompanied by what the administration assured us was sound intelligence, accurate intelligence, that Saddam Hussein had the capability, the capacity, and the intent to use weapons of mass destruction against us. That turned out not to be the case. We found out after the invasion. Moreover, the administration then used the resolution that Congress passed in late 2002 to take action against Saddam Hussein as an authorization for a multi-year occupation, which it was not intended. The Patriot Act is, as I've explained many times and as I've worked against for the last 5 years, was presented to us with certain assurances by the administration that it would not abuse the powers, that it would use them only for terrorism cases, that it would not seek to expand the powers, and that it would report to the Congress on its use so the Congress could evaluate the sunset provisions in it. The administration reneged on every one of those promises, and therefore I've led the effort really over the last 5 years to try and undo the damage of the Patriot Act. The Defense of Marriage Act, the operative provision, stands for the notion and the principle that each state can set and ought to be free to maintain its own definition of marriage and not have another definition from another state forced upon it.
Let's talk about the financial crisis. As a Libertarian, how do you propose the country deal with the financial crisis on Wall Street, whether it has to do with trust in the country's banking institution or whether it has to do with credit concerns? How do you propose dealing with that problem?
First of all, to highlight for the American people so they can make proper decisions, what caused this problem? It's not pointing back and laying blame like Sarah Palin keeps trying to say. It's simply understanding what the problem is, how we got here, so that we can properly take steps to assure that it does not happen again. This is a problem that is largely created by the government itself. by pushing bad mortgage policies, by loosening certain regulations with regard to the transparency and fiscal soundness or financial soundness of financial institutions that are regulated by the SEC, for example. So we have a major problem here that is largely of the government's making, and the American people ought to be very skeptical, to say the least, of giving the keys to the solution in the hand back into the hands of the people to cause the problem itself, with very little oversight. What the government is asking the American people to do is to give it carte blanche to a to expend probably upwards of $1 trillion on very risky investments. To have the government going out and buying up bad mortgage paper makes no sense whatsoever. And to now have the government, as they are doing, buying up shares in banks, that is partial nationalization of the banks, whether the banks like it or not, is going down a very, very ill-advised road. And we've had no hearings on this. It's all being done basically by a group of unelected bureaucrats in Washington, pursuant to very, very broad authority. And one thing that's missing from all this that we as libertarians would like to see is, where is the Department of Justice in all this? Why have there been no prosecutions for fraud? We know pretty much very clearly that there has been fraud perpetrated by a number of these institutions in inflating their books and cooking their books, but the government has not taken any action against them. We would also like to see some of the rules and regulations that were either relaxed or changed over the last few years. We'd like to see the SEC go back and really do its job of assuring the American people by enforcing the regulations that it's responsible for, to assure the American people that their investments are being handled properly, above board, without fraud, and with transparency.
Should banks, though, be allowed to fail? I mean, in a sense, to allow the free market system, although your description doesn't sound very much like a free market system, but to allow banks that made bad decisions, allow them to go under?
The marketplace, by and large, will correct itself. I don't think what we'd see is a bunch of banks going under, although that's what the government would like us to think the only alternative to massive government bailout is, that if the government doesn't bail out all of these entities, they're going to go under. What happened, for example, with Wachovia is very instructive. Wachovia has run into some very tough times, largely because of decisions that it made to buy up huge quantities of these bad mortgage-based securities. Well, what happened is Wells Fargo saw an opportunity to acquire Wachovia and to buy both the bad debt and the good assets that Wells Fargo believes are there, and they can turn this around. That's the way it ought to operate. It isn't as if all of these banks are all of a sudden going to go under. There are other financial institutions and investors out there who will buy them up and hopefully turn them around.
What do you see as the most important functions of the federal government?
Most important functions of the federal government are to institute a proper national defense, with the emphasis on defense, and domestically to assure the American people that their liberties are protected, not to take them away, as this administration has done with its domestic surveillance without court orders, for example, on the American people and reading their mail and so forth, but to actually protect the civil liberties that are guaranteed us in the Constitution. That's the job of the federal government, to maintain a good court system, to enforce those laws and regulations that are necessary to protect our civil liberties and to assure the American public, for example, in the financial arena, that their investments are going to be properly handled without fraud and with transparency.
You mentioned defense. What is your position on both the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Wherever there are those individuals, whether they're non-state actors or governments, who have taken or are poised and have the capability and the intent to take action against us, we have an obligation and a right to go after those individuals. And if they are in Afghanistan, we need to find them and take them out. Similarly, if there were any in Iraq, which apparently there weren't. What we need to do in Iraq is to begin dramatically and significantly and immediately reducing the security, the economic and military security blankets that we're providing Iraq to the tune of about $400 million a day. Let the Iraqi government sink or swim on its own. If they can't, after 5 years and 4,500 American lives and hundreds of billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars, then something is fundamentally wrong with that society, I dare say. But I do not favor, as Barack Obama does, simply taking those tens of thousands of U.S. troops in Iraq and shifting them to Afghanistan. We don't need to be stationing tens of thousands more U.S. troops in Afghanistan, essentially to provide domestic support for the Karzai government. What we need are much smaller, more carefully focused, based on good intelligence, operations against the Taliban or al-Qaeda or the others who would do us harm.
Do you think there's a need and a role for foreign aid?
In very, very limited circumstances. Humanitarian aid from time to time, certainly. If there is, in fact, an important military agreement that we have or relationship that we need to have with a country to assure ourselves of support when we need it, port facilities or whatnot, perhaps. But in terms of the, billions of dollars that we fork out year after year to the United Nations or to individual countries, no, I think by and large, and most expert, I think would back me up on this, it's essentially wasted money.
Wasted money, but so much of at least the war on terror, as it is described, is about winning hearts and minds. It's not so much about military defeat, but about how you win over people to a different kind of ideology. Do you believe that?
That's certainly true, but you don't win them over by buying them over. Very few instances, I'm not sure there are any, where we have been able to buy allies simply through giving them money, and those kind of allies are generally fair-weather friends anyway. Use of certain tools such as exchanges, cultural, economic, business exchanges, developing open markets are certainly very, very important, as are things such as radio and television, internet broadcasts, opening up the internet so that there's a robust exchange of ideas and so forth. All of those things are important.
And I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. I actually want to get some callers in on the conversation. We invited Bob Barr to join us today on Radio Times. He's the Libertarian Party presidential candidate this year, running for president in most states. And for a number of years, he represented Georgia's 7th congressional district in the U.S. House of Representatives. That was from 1995 to 2003, and he was a Republican at the time. As he has just told us, he converted to libertarian a couple of years ago, and he joins us this morning on Radio Times to talk about some of his policies and ideas. We want to hear from you. Any questions that you have for our guests, and the lines are open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Bob Barr staying with us for another 10 minutes. We'll be right back.
A proud supporter of WHYY, BNY Mellon Wealth Management is dedicated to helping financially successful individuals and families protect and grow their wealth. Details at BNYMellonWealthManagement.com.
Kimberton Waldorf School, a supporter of WHYY, will host an open house on Saturday, October 18th at 9 a.m. Attendees will view hands-on activities, meet faculty and students, and take a campus tour. Located in Chester County on over 480 acres, Kimberton Waldorf School offers an experiential approach to learning that integrates academics and the arts for children preschool through 12th grade. Details online at kimberton.org. Kimberton Waldorf School open house on Saturday, October 18th.
The next president will inherit a troubled economy.
We've had policies that have shredded consumer protections.
We are never going to let these kinds of abuses go uncorrected.
Tune in as John McCain and Barack Obama debate the woes of Wall Street. I'm Linda Wertheimer. Join me later today for special coverage of the 2008 presidential debates from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 o'clock on 91 FM and WHYY.org.
The Economist supports WHYY. Every week, The Economist covers issues that matter around the world and the connections between them. The Economist, on newsstands, in bookstores, and online at economist.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone talking with Bob Barr today on the show. He's the Libertarian Party presidential candidate this year, and we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Kevin from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Kevin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Mr. Bard. First, I'd like to start by congratulating you on your candidacy. I think it's very important to have third parties in the election process. My question speaks to fiscal responsibility. And we had the Fiscal Awareness Tour was in Philadelphia last night, and they spoke to the fact that entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare constitute about 40% of the federal budget. My question for you is, as a proponent of smaller, decentralized government, what do you think the government's role, if any, is in maintaining these programs, and if the answer is to reduce them, is expecting people to pay for their health care and these benefits on their own attainable course of action.
Kevin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Bob Barr, go ahead.
I couldn't quite understand the last part of the caller's question, but with regard to the entitlement programs, they clearly do need to be dramatically modified and substantially changed. Medicare and Medicaid and particularly Social Security is a real ticking time bomb. And this is one reason the Social Security, the looming bankruptcy of Social Security is one reason why so many young people are looking at the Libertarian Party and are very disenchanted with the Republican and Democrat parties, because they simply avoid the problem year after year after year. The Social Security system will go bankrupt very shortly. There'll be less money coming in than is going out in probably 9 years or so. And what we need to be doing, and we have proposed this, is to begin completely restructuring the program. Those who are older, such as my generation in their late 50s, for example, and above, leave the system essentially as it is. You're not going to be able to change it. It's too embedded. But for the younger workers, the new workers coming in, those that have been in the workforce, say, less than 10 years or so, begin to provide much more flexibility, control, and actual ownership for them of their Social Security funds, so that they have a hand in investing them and so that they actually own that retirement money. It is absolutely immoral for the federal government, as it's been doing for eight decades now, forcing the American people to pay money into what has become, unfortunately, a forced retirement plan, and not giving them any ownership interest in it.
Do you, though, have faith and trust that not just in Wall Street, but also that individual people can make wise decisions about where they and how they want to invest their money for the future?
Well, actually, we in the Libertarian Party have much more faith in the American people's ability to do that than the other two major parties do. But the plan that we have proposed does have controls in it. It is a realistic system that does not simply just open it up, but it does phase in the private investment accounts and place certain limitations on them, so you do have some checks and balances.
Let me get to Alton from, looks like, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Alton, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good morning.
When I tell my family and friends that I'm voting third party, I get that wasted vote response. The way I see it, when you vote for Democratic or Republican Party, you seem to get the same thing and there's no change in government. How do I respond to my family and friends about that wasted vote criticism?
Alton, thanks for the call. Bob Barr, go ahead.
Your caller has it exactly right. The definition of a wasted vote is to vote Republican or Democrat, because that guarantees that nothing of any substance will change. You look at the policies of Senator Barack Obama and Senator McCain, and there are minor differences, there are nuanced differences, there are rhetorical differences between the two of them, but so long as people vote for the Republicans or the Democrats, which are simply two sides of the status quo in Washington, nothing is going to change. That is a wasted vote. Voting for a party that truly does believe in and will practice and implement smaller government and more individual liberty is never a bad thing.
Alton, thanks for the call. We've got Wendell now from Kennett Square. Wendell, go ahead. You're Radio Times.
Yes. Well, I just caught Mr. Barr's comment on Social Security, which I completely disagree with. I don't think there's any basis for his making those comments. But I wanted to ask him what his position is on health care policy.
Wendell, thanks for the call. Bob Barr, go ahead.
Actually, in this arena, there are some aspects of Senator McCain's policy that, at least as it's been enunciated on health care, that do seem to make some sense. Those parts of his policy that have to do with reducing some of the anti-market restraints on the delivery of health care and health care insurance. It makes no sense, for example, for an individual or a business or a group of businesses that wish to insure their employees to be able to do so. It makes no sense to limit individuals acquiring health care wherever in the country from a company that they wish to. It makes no sense to force individuals to take health care coverage that they don't want or need. The individuals, people ought to have much more freedom to acquire the health care wherever they can, wherever they want, and whatever form best meets their needs. And we also need to start dramatically reducing the huge percentage of a doctor's practice and hospital's work that is consumed simply by the massive government paperwork.
The amount of bureaucracy involved in the current system?
Exactly. In my old district in Georgia, and when I represented that district in the Congress, we had a lot of doctors and regional medical centers there, and they told me consistently that virtually half of the entire overhead for their practice was consumed simply meeting government paperwork mandates.
Picking up on what you just said about healthcare, though, I can understand that, let's say, a young individual, a young person who is essentially healthy, would probably be able to use the market system to get health insurance for themselves. But if you're an older person, and an older person with chronic health problems that tend to be expensive health problems, under your system, how do they benefit? It seems to me that either the health insurance companies won't want them as their customers, or if they do, they're going to charge them a lot of money.
Well, I'm 59 years old. I'm in good health, certainly not perfect health. I have health care needs, and they're met by the insurance. I mean, there are plenty of plans out there. Do I like paying a lot of money for them? No. But I do recognize that it's an essential and responsible aspect of my and my family's needs to pay that money for it. I would certainly like to see the cost reduced dramatically by reducing some of the regulations, restrictions, and paperwork to keep that cost so high.
I know you have to leave us in a couple minutes. Let me just ask you one or two more questions before we have to say goodbye. And this applies to education, grades K through 12. You have talked about choice and competition. How would that work?
It would work by beginning by dramatically reducing and eventually, hopefully, eliminating the federal involvement in education. Educating our children was never contemplated and is not an authorized authority even implied under our Constitution. Parents ought to be able to make decisions in their communities with regard to the educational structure, whether it's homeschooling, local schooling, private schools, free from the federal government interference. The No Child Left Behind Act has become simply a bureaucratic maze and has become the tail wagging the dog. Schools play to and teach to test scores now as opposed to really improving the education of their children. We have a Department of Education that was formed 30 years ago for the express purpose of improving education. It has failed miserably to do so. And yet neither of the other two candidates dares question the Department of Education and the nearly $60 billion a year it spends not educating our children.
Would you want to get rid of, though, the public school system?
No, I wouldn't want to get rid of the public school system, but it needs to be much more controlled by local communities and parents, not the federal government.
All right, and one or two more questions. Let me just also give it that phone number, which is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-TALKING-WITH-477. Talking with Bob Barr today on the show, and he's the Libertarian Party presidential candidate this year. Talk to us about your position on guns.
I'm, of course, as is well known, a board member of the National Rifle Association. I believe that the Second Amendment very clearly protects an individual's right to keep and bear arms, that it should not be taken away, as the District of Columbia government did about 32 years ago in prohibiting the citizens in much the same way that the city of New York does from possessing a firearm to protect themselves. This is not only irresponsible, but winds up costing the government a lot more because people don't have the capacity to defend themselves.
Any restrictions, though, on gun ownership?
Sure. The NRA believes in the reasonable restrictions, such as keeping guns out of the hands of those who've been convicted of felonies, those who have been judged mentally incompetent, those who have surrendered their U.S. citizenship, and so forth. And certainly, the notion that an individual has the right to possess a firearm to protect himself or their family or for any other lawful purpose is not the same as and does not extend to military hardware such as bazookas and so forth.
Why did the NRA then endorse John McCain and not you?
I think they made a practical decision that he was more likely to win. It's problematic. I have an A+ rating from the NRA and serve on its board of directors. I have for about 13 years or so. John McCain has a lifetime rating of C+. So it was obviously not based on the substance or the principle of his positions, but a practical decision, I suppose.
When you were a member of Congress, you did propose a Pentagon ban on Wicca. That's a religion practiced in this country in the military. What is your position on religious freedom today?
That was not a question of religious freedom. I am a strong proponent of religious freedom. That was a proposal that came about as a result of talking with a number of military leaders at the time. This was about 10 years or so ago. Who indicated some concern with the burgeoning practice of Wicca on military bases by military personnel, and there was a concern on the part of some military officials that this was incompatible with and would cause problems with the good order and discipline of the military. As it has turned out over the last 10 years, and I've talked with a number of military leaders about this, it has not turned out to be a problem that they thought it might be initially. And therefore, I do not advocate any restrictions on it, but it had nothing to do with freedom of religion. It had to do with practices on military bases by military personnel and potentially interfering with the good order and discipline of the military.
Can we take one more call?
Only if you let me give out our website,
okay,
so your callers know.
No, give out your website, and then we'll take a caller.
The website for the campaign is bobbarr2008.com.
Let me get to Randy from media to join us. Randy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have one question that's always bothered me with the NRA, and I would like for somebody to please answer, not in statistics, but in common sense. What is wrong with having to wait 30 days to purchase a handgun? And don't we all agree that if everybody was required to wait 30 days, that we would save many lives for people buying guns for emotional reasons?
And, Randy, let me see what Bob Barr has to say. Bob Barr, go ahead.
If you recognize a right to possess a firearm, you have that right to possess a firearm. And the government has no affirmative right to make you wait for it while some bureaucrat decides if you're worthy or not to possess it. That is not the job of government. That is not the way our government was founded, simply to say, well, it's not going to hurt somebody if the government restricts their ability to do something, therefore the government should do it. Our government was set up the other way, so that there has to be a specific or clearly implied power to the government before it can do something. The fact of the matter is also that if somebody believes that their life is in danger, and there are documented, you might not like statistics, but there are a number of documented instances in which individuals, particularly women, who are facing abusive spouses, former spouses, or boyfriends, need to possess and purchase a firearm immediately because their life is in danger, and they have been denied the ability to do so in some jurisdictions, where they have waiting periods, and the results have been quite tragic.
On that note, Bob Barr, we have to say goodbye, and I thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. Thank you all for having me.
You're very welcome, and he's the Libertarian Party presidential candidate this year, joining us this morning on Radio Times. Well, yesterday, President Bush announced that the federal government was going to buy up shares in some of the nation's banks. This plan is estimated to cost some $250 billion, part of that $700 billion bailout package passed recently. Bush said this plan to partially and temporarily nationalize the country's banking system was, quote, not intended to take over the free market system, but to preserve it. The administration, Congress, and the Federal Reserve have taken a number of dramatic moves in the last few weeks to address the country's financial crisis, which is having global reverberations. We've asked Alan Bleiner to join us today on Radio Times to talk about all of this. He's co-director of Princeton University's Center for Economic Policy Studies. Alan Bleiner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Marty.
Let me begin with this announcement yesterday made by the president, this plan to inject capital into the banks. First of all, what's your overall reaction to that plan?
Well, I think it was probably a good thing to do. I'm not as enthusiastic about it as many of my fellow economists for reasons we'll probably get to. But frankly, I think it was necessary because the confidence in the banking system broadly conceived, including what we used to call investment banks, has been very sharply eroded and was in danger of evaporating entirely.
But we are talking, at least in the short term, about partially nationalizing some of the nation's banks.
Well, it turns out not. I mean, before the plan was announced, a lot of people were thinking that, but the plan that actually was promulgated yesterday would not give the government control of these banks at all. We will be the government, and when I say we taxpayers.
That's right.
Will be minority holders of preferred shares, not common shares, that won't even have a vote.
So the idea that yes, there will be the purchase of all these preferred stocks, but the government doesn't get to decide about what the particular bank does as a bank.
Right. And I think, frankly, that's doesn't give the taxpayer enough say for his and her money. That's one criticism I would make of the plan. But it's certainly not nationalization of the European model.
And we're almost up in a break here, but you're saying you would actually prefer the government to have some sort of vote or some sort of control over the bank's business?
I would. Not in great detail, but I mean, I'll give you one example. The banks are free to continue their current dividend payments.
Yes.
If I were in Secretary Paulson's shoes, I would not have allowed that. If banks are getting taxpayer money in on one door, they shouldn't be paying dividends out the other door.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Sorry about the confusion before getting the show started today. That's Alan Bleiner, our guest in this portion of Radio Times, co-director of Princeton Center for Economic Policy Studies. And we invited him to join us today on Radio Times to talk about the latest news, the fact that the Bush administration has this new proposal to inject capital into some of the nation's banks. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Dance Celebration kicks off its season at Annenberg Center with Parsons Dance, Thursday, October 16th through Saturday, October 18th. David Parsons premieres two works, Nascimento Novo by Brazilian composer Milton Nascimento and My Sweet Lord by the Beatles' George Harrison, also featuring Caught, Parsons' signature work. For tickets to the Annenberg Center, 215-898-3900 or online at penpresents.org. Dance Celebration joins you in support of WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Picture Maya Angelou waxing poetic at a Barack Obama inauguration.
I christen you Hosanna, Obama. Brown bomber, dark angel.
Or speaking for John McCain.
President-elect John McCain. Ain't this a bitch?
A comedy news show that tackles race from a different place.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY. University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Most college-bound high school seniors have questions ranging from what are classes like, to what activities can I do, to what about the food? To help students with their questions, University of the Sciences is holding a series of on-campus open houses. Prospective students are invited to tour the campus, talk to students, faculty, and staff, and learn about the admission and financial aid process. Open house details at usp.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Alan Blinder from Princeton University about the latest action by the federal government to buy shares in some of the nation's banks, part of the $700 billion bailout package. And we've got lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Professor Blinder, then what are these banks? And at this point, I think there are nine that have signed up for this. What are these banks supposed to do with this money?
Well, the idea is that this bolsters their capital bases, which had gotten perilously thin, and enables them to do more lending. I mean, the whole name of the game here in this part of the rescue package is to restore lending to, I don't want to say normality, it's a long way from normality, but something that's less restrictive than the world we're living in now, more lending.
Is there any guarantee, though, that these banks will do that?
No, and that was the other point I was going to make in partial criticism of what I think was a necessary step, which is that I would have liked to have seen more strings attached of the sort that would guarantee more lending.
How would that work?
And they aren't.
What would those strings look like?
Well, there would have been an agreement as part of the capital infusion that lending would expand. Probably if you do that, you want to make this more voluntary. I mean, as was clear from the newspaper accounts of the now famous meeting of the nine bank heads with Secretary Paulson, he essentially gave them a fait accompli and said, guess what, you're all volunteering for this project, even though some of them didn't. And now we're seeing press reports of lots of the smaller bankers anticipating that they may get pressured to go along when they don't want to, bridling under it, say, we don't really want this money. On the other hand, some banks do want the money and do need the money, and that's where I think we should have directed it with strings attached of the sort that I said. No more dividends while you have the money, and some guarantee that lending is going to go up, not down.
I've heard some critics over the last couple of days saying, you know, we haven't had a please or thank you from any of the bank executives. Do you think we're owed some kind of, if not apology, some kind of explanation? That report about this meeting that was held with Henry Paulson, apparently the representatives of the banks went straight to their limousines and not to the microphones or the waiting press. Are we owed something from these banks?
Well, I think we are generically, that most of these banks made, not all of them, by the way, and that's the point I was making before. Right. Some of them did not, but a lot of these banks made grievous errors that have cost them and their shareholders a lot of money. Well, that's proper capitalism, but have also caused harm to the economy and risk to the taxpayer. So I think we're owed lots of apologies by bankers, by regulators, by the U.S. Treasury, and so on. But to this particular issue of the capital infusion, as I said a moment ago, some of these bankers really didn't want it. So you could hardly expect them to say, thank you very much for doing this to us.
And when will we know if this actually is working?
Well, that's a very good question. I think you got to measure the time frame for that in weeks, or if not months, not in days. This kind of capital infusion is, as I said, meant to prop up the banks, give them better access to private capital, by the way, and get them lending more. And we'll see over the coming weeks and months to what extent it works.
Do you think there's too much focus on the Dow Jones, that we are sort of defining our financial, even economic priorities and policies based on the ups and downs of the Dow Jones Industrials?
Oh, much too much, I think, especially in the public. The problem is the one piece of financial information that's in front of the eyeballs of the public is the Dow Jones Industrial average. This is by no means the most important indicator or even anywhere close to it, and in many cases is a sideshow. What we care about is the volume and terms of lending credit operations of all sorts. These are indicated by loan volumes and by what are called credit spreads that nobody except experts ever looks at. And what that means is how much does borrower X have to pay above what the U.S. Treasury has to pay. The Treasury always borrows at the cheapest rates because it's completely riskless borrower, totally safe borrower. But if you or I go to the bank or a corporation goes to the bond market or to the commercial paper market or wherever, there's a spread over treasuries. The interest rate is higher, and those are the things that need to be watched.
Because Monday, of course, was that 936-point jump in the market. Yesterday, things were a little volatile and ended a little bit below what happened on Monday, and it seems as if their mental health practically is tied to the ups and downs of the Dow Jones or the market itself.
You're 100% right. Most people, now there are exceptions, of course, but most people should try as best they can to ignore the day-to-day fluctuations in the market. None of us can successfully time the market. I would have loved to have bought a huge amount of stock at the close on Friday and sold it on the close on Monday, but I'm not smart enough to do that. I didn't know what was going to happen on Monday. And basically, neither is anybody else.
Looking at this this plan, and then I do want to get to our callers, and there are a number of other things I'd like to put on the table as well, but this seems to be part of a cooperative measure with some of our allies in Europe, whether it's Great Britain, Germany, or France. Do you see this as healthy cooperation between these countries?
Very much so, very much so, and an astonishing degree of cooperation. All these countries don't have a great track record of effective cooperation with one another. But the broad outlines of what the countries agreed to do, just in very broad terms, over the weekend, has been followed through upon, including by the United States, with, of course, variations from country to country. As I said in answer to, I think, your first question, we're not going down the road of nationalizing banks, at least I don't think so, whereas some European countries are. That reflects cultural, political, and traditional differences, but all of us, all the countries are injecting capital into banks in one way or another. All of them are guaranteeing bank-to-bank lending in one way or another. All of them are improving protection for bank depositors in one way or another. Not exactly the same way, but it's an astonishing degree of international coordination.
But it shows how our fates, our financial fates, are tied together.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why we need this international cooperation. That's why it's such a good thing that we're finally getting it.
And that's Alan Blinder, our guest today in this portion of Radio Times, co-director of Princeton University's Center for Economic Policy Studies. He also served as vice chair of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. That was from 94 to 96 and was a member of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors from January 93 to June of 1994. 1-888-477-9499. Let me get a couple of callers in on the conversation. We've got Chuck from Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Chuck, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Marty. Thanks a lot. Fantastic show.
I've been
crying out about this for weeks, and I may even sent you an email last week. I think it's important to realize that these banks are also the investment firms, the type of which Hank Paulson ran. Goldman Sachs, his former firm, is going to get $10 billion of federal money, and Paulson is now going to control a 20% interest in Goldman Sachs with taxpayer money.
You see a conflict of interest there, Chuck?
I just think it's a little scary that we're spending $250 billion on Wall Street. Nobody's asking the question, who's going to control this? And Paulson is the one who's going to control it. We're taking a 20% interest in J.P. Morgan Chase, in Wells Fargo, in Goldman Sachs, in Morgan Stanley, Paulson's former firm and his competitors' firms, and he's the one who's going to be pulling the trigger on it. And if anybody thinks that a non-voting share isn't going to have an influence on how companies run, they've never been in a public company. I can tell you, as a former executive of a public company, a 20% shareholder, whether they're showing up at stockholder meetings or not, is going to drive policy.
Well, Chuck, let me take your point, and you've got some good ones there, and see what Alan Blinder has to say. Chuck, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Professor Blinder, go ahead.
Yeah, well, Chuck raises some very valid points. The so-called TARP, T-A-R-P legislation that passed Congress about 10 days ago gives the Secretary of the Treasury extraordinary authority to do as he pleases. It was originally designed to buy mortgages and mortgage-related securities. That's the language in the bill. But then there's another clause that essentially says he can do anything he wants in the interest of financial stability with the approval of the chairman of the Federal Reserve. So these actions to inject capital are done under that clause with the approval of the chairman of the Fed, and it is true, as Chuck says, the Secretary of the Treasury can do anything he wants. It is also true, as he said, that a piece of that capital injection went to his former company, Goldman Sachs, and to eight other big companies, and it's presumably going to go to 1,000 or more other banks before it is over. So in terms of control about where the money goes, yeah, the Secretary of the Treasury has a tremendous amount of almost unlimited power. In terms of controlling what the companies do, I was talking about that earlier. I think the design of this program actually doesn't give, as I said, the government enough say over matters like dividends and expanding loans and so on.
But I think what Chuck's point was that even if the government doesn't have a vote, it is the government, and it might be, you know, sitting quietly around the table, but nonetheless hard to ignore.
Well, that's exactly right, and you saw that at this now famous meeting at the Treasury, right, where the Treasury, Mr. Paulson and Mr. Bernanke, got these CEOs around the table and says, guess what? You're participating in this voluntary program. Well, the participation wasn't very voluntary. The government can do things like that.
But just to underscore that, I mean, these are closed meetings. This is the public's money. We're talking about taxpayer money. Are you concerned about that, just the level of secrecy with this bailout?
I'm not so far. There is a potential to worry about that. The meeting was secret. It was private. It was sort of a business meeting in which the Riot Act was read to the bank CEOs. You want them to have the opportunities sort of to react frankly to that. What's crucial is the terms of the deal be made completely transparent and public, and they have been. There's no secrecy about that.
Now, Ben Bernanke, head of the Federal Reserve, has offered FDIC, actually has offered unlimited guarantee on non-interest-bearing bank deposits. These are bank deposits used by small businesses. Can you speak to that?
Well, more big businesses, actually, because the FDIC insurance had been extended to any account up to $250,000, which is enough to cover most. Millions and millions of small businesses never, ever have a bank balance bigger than that. But once you get to medium-sized and larger businesses, you can have a need to have that much money in your checking account to pay payroll and other things of that nature. It wouldn't have been my favorite thing to do, but I think as long as it's limited to that, it's not going to be harmful. There have been some voices calling to do what Germany and Ireland and some other countries have done, which is just expand the blanket of FDIC insurance coverage to every single dollar on deposit in U.S. banks. I don't think that would have been wise. Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, just in this morning's Washington Post, explained why it wouldn't have been wise, but that's not what the government did.
Is this all about trust and confidence? Bottom line?
Bottom line it is, yes. It's absolutely about trust and confidence. When you have the spectacle of the biggest international banks, some of which are U.S. banks, but many of which are foreign banks, being unwilling to lend to one another for more than a couple of days because they feared their counterparty might go bankrupt, that's a total evaporation of confidence, yes.
And we've done whole hours about this, and I still scratch my head because you just wonder how, you know, rotten, bad mortgages and people unable to pay their mortgages could bring down a financial system worldwide.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. I think the answer is, it would take a week to answer that question.
I understand.
But to try to answer it in a minute, I think the two crucial pieces of the answer are derivatives and leverage. So first of all, tons of these derivative products were built on top of the base of these mortgages, creating kind of an inverted pyramid. So you had a relatively small number of mortgages and a relatively large number of derivatives built upon that, and that made the system worse. Second was leverage. You had, especially investment banks, buying and selling these things, but in particular when they were buying, they were often buying with balance sheets that had 33-to-1 leverage. What does that mean?
Right.
That means if the asset goes down in value by 3%, you're wiped out. It has no value because you've leveraged it 33-to-1. That's a very risky way to do business.
And have we, and I mean that we in that very collective sense, have we learned our lessons?
Yes. Yes and no. We've learned some very specific lessons. I think it's going to be a long time before we see these exotic and I might say crazy derivatives like CDOs and CDO squareds. Never mind what that is. They're crazy stuff. I don't think we're going to be seeing them for a very, very long time. It's clear that the financial system is deleveraging and will be using much less leverage going forward. But I have to tell you, there's a history of speculative markets, and after a period of time, these lessons will be forgotten, and we'll go back to the bad old ways. But this experience has been so big and so searing, it's going to take a long time before we get back to those attitudes.
And we just go back to our bad old ways because there's so much money, potential money to be made in the system?
Exactly. Because it's said that markets alternate between being motivated by greed and being motivated by fear. Now it's fear. It's absolute fear, catatonic fear. And so people are behaving very, very conservatively. As the crisis abates and as the economy improves, and that'll take a while, the greed will start creeping back into the picture. And if we have a run of good years, as we did from, say, 03, 04, 05, 06, people will start forgetting about risk and greed will completely overwhelm fear.
Well, on that note, that cautionary note, Alan Blinder, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times. And he's a co-director of Princeton Center for Economic Policy Studies. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program, including things like podcasts. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.